This episode contains explicit language.
White people will go and discover the coolest place in the back of a trailer park. They're comfortable anywhere. It could be very uncomfortable for a black person to walk into an all-white place. It could even be dangerous. In order for a black person to walk into a space, there has to be signals that says you're welcome.
Every time you walk into a restaurant, you're bombarded with signals, codes that tell you what kind of place it is and whether it's for you. Some signals are obvious, the food, the decor, the prices, but others are more subtle.
It's the uniform or lack thereof that somebody's wearing. It's a tablecloth that's there or not there.
Then there's the people working there and the other customers. Those are codes too.
We'll kind of get to this new restaurant, and if my friends see other people who look like us, other Asian Americans, it sends a signal to us that, oh, this is a place for us.
The more mixed a place is, the better I feel about it.
Why don't white people feel comfortable around black people?
What is on your mind when you can't go into a restaurant when there are people that don't look like you?
Today on The Sporkful, we're launching a new series on race, culture, and food called Who Is This Restaurant For? We'll talk with chefs, restaurant owners and customers, food writers and professors, comedian W. Kamau Bell, and many others.
I said, I don't want you ever to be blind to race. When you see a table walk in, racialize them immediately.
Can a restaurant be for everybody? And if it could, is that even what people want?
You know, we're not interested in being sitting beside each other. We're interested in having what we want to have, period.
People want to be in a space that's integrated, but it's hard to do it.
Some people want integration. I travel the country enough to know a lot of people absolutely don't want that. They're looking for a place where they feel comfortable, and for a large percentage of this country, comfortable means people who look like me, act like me, and smell like me.
WNYC Studios, this is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. And this week, as part of our ongoing discussions of race and culture and food, we're actually going to drop four episodes, a special series we're calling Who Is This Restaurant For? And I'm really excited to have a co-host for this episode. My friend and colleague Kat Chow covers race and culture for the excellent NPR podcast and blog Code Switch. Hey, Kat.
Hey, Dan.
So we're going to spend a lot of this episode going to different restaurants in Washington, D.C., where you live. You're going to be my tour guide, right?
Totally.
Okay. All right. I'm ready for that.
All right. But first, let's go to Todd Kleiman. Dan, you kind of know a little bit more about his work.
Yeah. So Todd Kleiman is a writer and a reporter based in D.C. He was a restaurant critic in D.C. for years. And he actually taught literature at Howard University, which is a historically black college in D.C. Todd, however, is white. And his experience teaching at Howard had a big impact on him.
Within that time that I was on campus, I was always the other. And so that was fascinating. It's not to say that I shed my skin and I became this other person. But it is to say that I was made to see with other eyes and to feel what that's like and how hard that can be, how amazing it can be, how just different it can be.
Todd says that in his work as a restaurant critic, he became very aware of the racial mix he saw at different restaurants. Most of the time, there wasn't much of a mix. And Todd, he wanted to try to understand why not.
That led him to write an article about the signals restaurants send. It was called Coding and Decoding Dinner. It was published last year in Oxford American. A code in a restaurant is any detail that sends a message. A tablecloth says you're expected to talk quietly to know how to peruse a wine list. If you haven't had that experience, you might not fit in here. Loud music says, hey, if you like to party, come on in. If you're a little older, you don't hear so well, you should probably look elsewhere. And there are the prices. If you're in a neighborhood where rents are going up, a new restaurant with high prices tells you, we're just counting the days till you're gone.
Racial codes in restaurants are especially important in D.C., which has been called Chocolate City. But since 1970, the black population has dropped from 71% to 50%. Here's Todd Kleiman again.
D.C. is this mix of You know, now you've got 25 to 35 year olds representing close to 40% of the population. And at the same time, you have a lot of older Black folks who have been here a long time and make up, you know, what you could think of as sort of the indigenous population. You see these kind of grinding edges in the gentrification debate. It's troubling because you have so many places now that are opening in these kind of transitional neighborhoods. And you have white restaurateurs who don't seem to understand where they are. And they don't, you know, they may say, well, you know, we want everybody to come. People are not going to come just because you want them to come. And particularly if you're trying to bring folks together, you have to make conscious decisions to do that.
One person who has made those kinds of conscious decisions to try to attract a diverse crowd is Andy Shalal. He's an Iraqi-American who owns a restaurant in D.C. called Busboys and Poets. The first one opened in 2005, and now there are six around the city. Later in the show, we'll go there and talk with Andy. Todd Kleiman says Busboys is full of codes, from their murals of civil rights leaders to the menu.
I remember having a conversation with Andy Shalal before Busboys and Poets opened, and he said, look, we're going to have chorizo, but we're not going to call it chorizo. We're going to call it pepperoni. Some people think that the decisions he made were actually not just self-conscious, but even pandering.
But Busboys is one of the most integrated spaces in D.C. And the mix of people in any restaurant, that's another code. You walk in, you see who's working there, who else is eating there, tells you what kind of place it is.
Yeah. Whenever I go to a Chinese restaurant with my friends who are also Asian American, if we see other people who look like us, other Asians, it kind of sends this signal to us that maybe this is a place for us.
And restaurateurs know that a lot of us feel that way. That's why they put thought into the mix of their customers and the signal that it sends.
Well, I heard one restaurateur tell me about something called the 60-40 rule. I mean, he said it off the record. The rule is that if you have a restaurant and your population, the mix goes from more than 60% white and 40% Black, if it starts becoming 42% Black, 45% Black, very quickly, it'll be a very slippery slope and it'll become a majority Black restaurant in no time. And I think there was a sense from him that to become a majority Black restaurant or an all-Black restaurant would have been bad for business.
Todd says he heard about the 60-40 rule from a couple other white restaurateurs. But to be clear, this is anecdotal. Later in the show, we'll get some other perspectives on this. Back in studio, Kat asked Todd a question she'll be asking each of our guests today.
Can you make a restaurant for everybody?
I think maybe you could try, but restaurants have always been about creating us versus them. You know, we like to think that food is about inclusion. We like to think that restaurants are places where we bring everybody together, and they can be. But very often, very, very often, they are places where we mark. Restaurants are exclusionary spaces.
I suspect, Todd, that some people who are listening to our conversation are thinking they're hearing a white guy and me sitting here having this conversation and probably thinking, like, who the hell are these guys?
Mm-hmm. Right. No skin in the game, I think is the phrase.
Like, what do you say when you get that reaction?
Well, I haven't had that reaction, but I can anticipate that reaction. My reaction would be, yeah, I can see why anybody would be maybe bothered, but most people don't know how I've grown up. They don't know the experiences I've had. I'm not coming at this, I think, in a surface way. And I think that the best conversations, if we're talking simply about Black and white here, the best conversations will make both Black and white feel uncomfortable.
That's Todd Kleiman. His piece in Oxford American is called Coding and Decoding Dinner. We'll link to it at Sporkful.com. Quick note on the 60-40 rule. We reached out to Professor Krishnendu Ray, chair of the Food Studies Department at NYU and author of The Ethnic Restaurateur. We asked him about this idea that says that if more than 40% of a restaurant's customers are Black, white people won't go there. Have you ever heard of this rule?
I have not heard of this specific rule.
But does the idea underlying it ring true to you?
It does ring true to me. It rings very true. And I would do the analogy through residential segregation. So there's a rich literature on housing, and there's a lot of interesting work which says when a number of African Americans in a neighborhood reaches a threshold, it can flip. You will have white flight.
Coming up, Kat and I will visit three restaurants in D.C. that are coded in really different ways, including Busboys and Poets, which we just discussed. We'll talk to the owners and customers to see what happens when the signals a place sends bring certain people in and keep others out. Stick around. Welcome back to The Sporkful from WNYC Studios. I'm Dan Pashman. Please make sure you subscribe to our podcast wherever you get it. That way, you'll never miss an episode. Go ahead and hit subscribe right now while you're listening. Thanks. Now I want to welcome back my co-host for this episode, Kat Chow from the NPR podcast and blog Code Switch. Hey again, Kat.
Hey, Dan.
So one quick thing I want to cover before we get too far ahead of ourselves. There's a term coming up in this next segment that people are going to hear, safe space. And some of you may not be familiar with that term in this context. So, Kat, if a restaurant is a safe space, that doesn't mean, like, you won't get beat up there.
It's basically a place where you can go and you can be yourself and you can feel comfortable. And you can also not have that obligation to make other people feel okay or comfortable.
Kat and I hopped in a cab and headed out to visit three restaurants around D.C. to see how different places send different codes to customers. Now, if you're going to open a restaurant, one of the biggest decisions you make is where to open it. Typically, you're going to want to send signals to attract the people who live nearby, right? But when a neighborhood starts changing and new people start moving in, that can get complicated. Thanks, have a good one.
We went to a cafe, video, and bookstore called Sankofa. It's right near Howard University in the Georgia Ave area. It's a predominantly black neighborhood with a lot of history. But gentrification, it's closing in from all sides. Here's Sharikiana Garima. She's black. She and her husband, Haile, are co-founders of Sankofa.
My husband and I make movies. And the movie that this establishment is named after is called Sankofa. And that was made 25 years ago. So it takes place during slavery. And it's very much immersed in the idea of resistance, that resistance was the determining factor for slavery not continuing. And because there was such a gap in that kind of way of looking at our past, the film did really well in the context of independent filmmaking.
Sankofa means going back to our past in order to go forward. Sharikiana and her husband used the money they made from the film to buy this building right by Howard, where they've also taught. Their main goal was to have a place to produce more films.
When we moved in here, we started looking at the space, thinking of the kind of creative things to do. And my crazy husband looks at the space downstairs and says, you know, why don't we have a bookstore here? So, like, trying to figure out ways to fund these movies wasn't enough and distribute them wasn't enough. We opened a bookstore.
The cafe was added more recently. As you enter, the sign above the door says, by people of African descent, about people of African descent.
Inside, there's a small counter where you can get coffee, cookies, sandwiches. Then there's a larger space that fits about a dozen tables. Each sandwich on the menu is named after an independent black filmmaker. They tell me the most popular is the Kathleen Collins. She was the first black American woman to produce a feature-length film. And that sandwich is smoked salmon, pesto, dill, capers, red onion, organic spinach, and pepper jack cheese. Sounds really good. There's a screen in the back for showing films, and the walls are lined with videos and books by people like Malcolm X, W.E.B. Du Bois, and many more. When we were there, there were about 20 black people and one white person, not counting me.
We wanted to have a black space. It is an intentional endeavor.
This is Tensai Berhanu. He's black. He runs the cafe at Sankofa.
We feel it is important to have a space where we can explore our past meaningfully and to be able to discuss our current situation so that we have a better understanding of how to move towards our new future. It is an idea-based business.
Sankofa's mission, it hasn't changed much over the years, but the neighborhood around it has. More white people are moving in, and some of them say that Sankofa doesn't feel like it's for them. On a local blog, a commenter referred to it as an exclusive business.
People wanted to be somewhat politically correct, so they didn't say that this is a black space, but they put it under, quote, exclusive. You know, some did say they don't feel comfortable being here. Some said, unless you have issues with yourself, I haven't had any problems coming in here. I come in here, the people are pleasant, I get my cup of coffee, and I go.
D.C. is losing its black culture.
Here again is Sharikiana Garima.
When you plow into a community that is primarily black, has been black, and in the middle of gentrification, and then build that so-called safe space for everybody, is it safe for those people that are being displaced? It's ushering in a gentrified era. So Anacostia will not be, or Southeast will not be, what it was before that restaurant came, to make it a safe place for, let's be real, for white people coming across the bridge to feel comfortable. So we can fool ourselves in a certain way, or we can be honest.
We asked Shirikiana and Tensai about the 60-40 rule. If your customers in a restaurant are more than 40% black, white people won't go there.
You're making a face.
Wow.
I didn't know about that.
And not that
it's sort of something that you sort of know without articulating it. I mean, you.
Because how often do you ever go to a restaurant that's where the customers are 80% black?
You know, constantly.
Really?
Really?
Tell me, we'll go.
I mean, okay, so keep in mind, how long have you guys been here?
I've been here for 4 years.
I'm actually based in New York.
One of the things that I'm noticing about this current era of gentrification is that it's been so complete that I feel like I'm speaking to aliens. The questioning should be in the reverse. Just flip it a bit. Why don't white people feel comfortable around black people? And if you answer that question, maybe you can figure out why it's so necessary to displace them in order to live with them. So nobody's ever said, don't come to D.C. because you're white. I've never heard anybody say that. Come, be my neighbor, buy the house up the street next door to me. I don't care. But do I have to be displaced for you to live here? Is your coming here contingent on my leaving? And when you come, can you look at me and say, oh, that's interesting, let me come and look at your restaurant, as opposed to starting to ask me, what's wrong with me for being here? What is on your mind when you can't go into a restaurant when there are people that don't look like you? Sit the hell down and order something, be quiet.
One of the questions that I've been wondering about is, can a restaurant be for everybody?
Why wouldn't it be for everybody?
Having to address this kind of question becomes absurd.
It's absurd. It's really absurd. I really don't want to answer a question like that. What restaurant's not for anybody? I feel like I'm upside down. Racism's affecting me. So I shouldn't have to justify being who I am because racism has turned things upside down.
And I don't want, I hope you don't take Kat's question or my questions to suggest that you need to justify anything. But I guess to sort of piggyback on what Kat was asking, you know, in the process of working on this show, I've spoken, you may not feel this way, but I know I've spoken to other African Americans who say when they go into a restaurant, if they're the only black person and every other customer there is white, they don't feel so welcome in that space. And I suspect that many white people would say the same if they were the only white person in a space that everyone else was black. I'm sorry, I just want to understand, like, is it that you don't think people do feel that way, or you feel like they shouldn't feel that way? I just am trying to understand your perspective.
Okay, so I'm so used to going to white restaurants, into white airplanes, into white everything, that how would I feel uncomfortable? I mean, unless I've adjusted to a level of discomfort, maybe that has happened. But I live in a white world.
Do you know what that means? No. I live in a world white. So it's not only white, but it's defined by whiteness. I'm supposed to, you know, my hair is supposed to be straight and flowy. I'm supposed to have, you know, a svelte, whatever white frame, you know, even that's narrow and stereotypic. I'm supposed to be able to speak in a white framework. I'm supposed to be able to, you know, do a number of things that are defined by somebody else's way of being. So when do I walk down the street and not feel uncomfortable?
After speaking with Shirkiana and Tensai, we talked with some Sankofa customers. We asked one group of four why they chose this spot. Here's Aaron.
It's also one of the few places that has consistently good vegetarian and vegan food. So as a black vegetarian, sometimes vegan when I can make myself do it, it's one of the few places that I can come to eat and have radical conversations and then pop over and buy a book of poetry by Amiri Baraka.
You remember earlier we talked about Busboys and Poets, which is one of the most integrated restaurants in D.C., although it's also been accused of pandering. Kat and I started telling this group at Sankofa about the story we're working on, and before we mentioned Busboys...
Are we going to name
it? Busboys?
We don't necessarily need to name
names. I feel like if you're going to have a real conversation, you should talk about the role that Busboys and Poets plays and tries to pretend like they're super radical and then just like commoditizes people of color radical experience, and they put up MLK and was it the Dalai Lama, MLK, and Gandhi, and it's like dream, faith, love...
One member of this group, Rebecca, is white. She also has issues with Busboys.
I think a lot of my beef with Busboys and Poets, right, is it's selling a version of diversity that is the, like, white people love that version of diversity. It's like a cleaned up, like, we can all be on the same team, and, like, diversity can be beautiful, and social justice can be beautiful, and yet underneath an actual diversity is a lot of pain and a lot of discord, and I think... In the same way that white people, we feel like, you know, everything should be comfortable for us, like diversity in a restaurant should also be comfortable for us. And so Busboys is selling this form of diversity that's comfortable, that's packaged, that's cleaned up, that's not actually real.
At this point, Dan turned to another member of the group, Brittany. She's black.
Why is it so hard to just create a restaurant where you see a really integrated mix of people and where they can all feel welcome and respected and treated the way they deserve to be treated?
When you think about like any small place like this restaurant, restaurants in general is like a microcosm of the real world, and that's not real in the real world, so why would we expect it in this place, you know? And maybe we're being presumptive in that we assume people want that, but we want to be integrated, we want to sit beside each other. I think maybe what we see, you know, maybe white people, when they see what they like, they don't want to sit beside it. They want to have it. They want to wear it like a costume. You know, we're not interested in being sitting beside each other. We're interested in having what we want to have, period.
From Sankofa, Kat and I got into a cab and headed to Slim's Diner.
Slim's Diner, which is about a mile up north on the same street, Georgia Ave, as Sankofa. Completely different neighborhood, Petworth, which is a neighborhood that's basically being gentrified and becoming less black.
As we drove, we passed new luxury buildings with big for lease signs, an African hair braiding place, and a Starbucks. The owner of Slim's is a guy named Paul Rupert. He's white. Kat listed the places he owns or used to own.
He owns Petworth Citizen, which is actually right around the corner from where we're driving now. He used to own a place called Crane and Turtle, which was more of a sit-down-y restaurant. And then he also owns Slim's Diner, in addition to a bunch of other places.
Like a high-end cocktail bar called The Passenger. So he's like a pretty big deal in the D.C. restaurant scene.
Yeah, exactly. And we want to get out here. So
okay.
Do you mind pulling over to the right?
Paul Rupert says he knew this area was changing. He saw that new people were moving in, and he saw a business opportunity. But his goal with Slim's is to appeal to both the newcomers and the folks who've been there a long time.
From the looks of it, it's working. When we were there, we were struck not only by how racially diverse the crowd was, but also the range of ages. We saw 20-somethings, parents with young kids, and middle-aged couples. Basically, the kind of crowd you'd expect at a classic diner. And the staff is just as diverse.
Then there's the decor. Big, cushy red booths, formica tables, a counter with stools. The place is such a quintessential diner, it almost looks like a movie set. Todd Kleiman, who we talked to at the start of the show, he says that's by design. From a coding perspective, Slim's is sort of a blank slate. But that lack of overt signals, it's still a choice. It's still self-conscious. And owner Paul Rupert says the name of the place is no exception.
By choosing the name Slim's, that's a kind of a traditional nickname that, to me, doesn't have connotations of race, for instance. It's an older nickname, so it harkens back to, you know, an older time.
Paul's other restaurants have dishes like dayboat scallops and beet mousse. At Slim's, it's things like omelets, pancakes, burgers, pie.
The food itself is inexpensive. It's traditional diner, although there are some modern components to it. There's lots of vegetarian offerings. There's lots of gluten-free offerings. And there are no esoteric ingredients. You know, when we were first working on the project, I interviewed lots of chefs. And a promising candidate in our third meeting, he said, I want to do duck bacon. Now, I love duck bacon, but it doesn't belong, in my mind, on the menu at Slim's Diner. Now, it could belong on a menu at another diner, a fancier diner, but that's not something that I wanted. And so we ended up not hiring that candidate because of that.
Walk me through the chain reaction. Like, duck bacon sends what message to what people and makes who less likely to come?
Well, it's not that it makes people less likely to come. It's really it sends a same message to everyone, which is that regular bacon is not good enough and that we're serving fancy bacon.
And
it's the same message whether you're black, white, purple, or green, you know. Even people who are looking for status or elevation in their dining experience, those same people at other times in their life want a diner. On a Saturday morning, they're going to want bacon and eggs.
Kat, I think this is the great moment for you to ask your recurring question.
Okay, so my recurring question. I feel like we need to have a drum roll, Dan. But basically, can a restaurant be for everybody?
No. You know, at Slim's, we try to be for as many people as possible, but there are lots of people who don't want to come here.
When you get that reaction, like, how does that make you feel?
Well, it's impossible to be all things to all people, so I try my best to be welcoming to people, but I certainly understand there are lots of places I don't like to go, and I don't take that personally.
Who would you imagine would feel not welcome here?
Well, again, I hope everyone feels welcome here. I mean, that's the whole point. Who wouldn't feel welcome here? I mean, there's certain folks who have been in the neighborhood for a long time who I'm sure have objections to someone from outside the neighborhood opening restaurants, and they have a different response, and some of them choose not to come here.
After talking with Paul, Kat and I spoke with some of the customers at Slim's. We met a white family that had just moved into Petworth the day before. They told us why they picked this neighborhood.
We wanted to have the traditional D.C. experience.
Yes.
What are the elements of that experience?
Walking distance to great restaurants like Slim's, being in a multicultural community.
Yeah.
Great opportunities for our kids.
Open, accepting.
One of the things that can be fraught when you move into a neighborhood, in part because it's a diverse neighborhood, is that the people who have been there for a long time may feel like you're not coming to live side by side, but that you're coming to displace them. Even if that's not your intention, that's sometimes how it's perceived. How do you navigate that?
That's a really great question, and we've actually talked about that. And in some ways, I feel weird about it. Like, I don't want anybody to think, oh, God, you know, I have some snooty new neighbor, you know. I go out of my way to say hello to the people on the street. We don't want to be that guy.
Right.
We don't want to be perceived as in a negative way. We hope we're not.
We also spoke with a middle-aged black woman named Barbara.
Barbara, do you live nearby?
I live about less than a mile away.
How long have you lived in this area, in this neighborhood?
My whole life. I grew up here. Live in the house I grew up in.
How did you hear about this place?
I drive by all the time, going to the library, and was very, very happy to see a restaurant in our area. Extremely happy.
Why?
Because there's not a lot to choose from except fast food, and they have vegetarian items on their menu, and I'm vegetarian. So I was very happy to see that.
I know that there's been a lot of changes in this neighborhood in the last few years. How are you feeling about those changes?
I think it's great. I think that a more diverse neighborhood, lots of different kinds of folks moving into the area, lots of different restaurants, a lot of folks walking and moving around. I think it's wonderful. Everyone speaks. Everyone's friendly. I think people make more of it who are from outside, who think that you should be having problems. There aren't any.
All right, Kat, give me the D.C. residence rundown. What is Busboys and Poets?
Okay, so Busboys and Poets, it's this sort of coffee shop, bookstore, restaurant, bar at night. The vibe of Busboys and Poets is that it's a place that seems to really care about social justice. And among people I know, it's seen as that place where you go to listen to spoken word poetry, which is, I'll let you decide whatever that means.
And insert your opinion of spoken word poetry here.
Yeah, and there are six Busboys and Poets locations. One's in 14th Street, where we're going, the first one, and there are a bunch all around D.C.
Busboys is owned by Andy Shalal, who's Iraqi-American. We went to the original location. It's in a neighborhood called U Street, which is kind of sacred ground in the D.C. black community.
Yeah, during the Jim Crow era, it was called Black Broadway. It's where Duke Ellington and Cab Calloway performed. It's where Thurgood Marshall and Langston Hughes lived. In fact, the name Busboys and Poets is a reference to Hughes, who was a busboy before becoming a poet.
In the late 60s, this area saw some of the country's worst race riots. After that, a lot of factors came together to decimate the neighborhood. Government neglect, corruption, and more. The causes are complicated and not really the topic we're covering today.
But over the past 10 years or so, U Street has changed again. Now it's the most gentrified neighborhood of the three we're visiting.
When we first went into Busboys, I was struck by how huge the space is. I mean, it's not a hybrid space. There's a whole restaurant and a whole bookstore and a bar and a lounge and a performance space, which is where you see that mural we heard so much about with MLK and Gandhi and so many others on it. The customers were a real mix. The first woman you'll hear is white, the next two are black.
I look for restaurants that are vegetarian friendly, and this one is fabulous in that regard. And it also has the added bonus of being an art-filled, artful space that's very community-minded, lots of good social justice causes. So I appreciate that.
Because it's Busboys and Poets, I just expect it to be so diverse because that's what they intend. They do that so intentionally, and they do it well.
Can you tell me just in general, when you walk into a restaurant, what are some of the things that you look for that maybe tell you that you are more or less welcome?
So if I walk in and there's a host stand that someone greets me, yeah, that I'm treated like my money is green.
That specific issue of how people are greeted when they walk in the door, it was something we heard from a lot of people of color we talked with.
In order for a black person to cross the threshold to walk into a space, there has to be signals that says you're welcome.
This is Andy Shalal, owner of Busboys and Poets. He says at Busboys, those signals include the music, the staff, the prices, the decor. Then there's the menu, which is as diverse as the customers he's trying to attract. There's soul food like catfish and shrimp and grits, Middle Eastern options like falafel and baba ganoush, lots of vegetarian and vegan choices, and then old standbys like burgers and pizza.
Andy was inspired to create a space like Busboys from his own experience. So he and his family, they came to the U.S. from Iraq when he was 10 in 1966. That was the height of the civil rights era.
It's very weird to come from a country that doesn't have race as a defining distinction between folks, to come in here and suddenly race is so hard in this country, such a straight line. You're black or you're white. And that's changing a little bit. You know, people are choosing biracial and choosing other and choosing all these. When I came here, that was not a choice. If you did not pick on the box whether you're black or white, somebody picked it for you by eyeballing. I never fit in. I did not fit in spaces that were like uniquely one or uniquely the other. I thought, I need a space of my own. I need a space that I could feel comfortable in.
People want to be in a space that's integrated. They want to be in spaces where different people come in, all feel good about being here, but it's hard to do it.
In order to do it, Andy goes way beyond offering a diverse menu and hiring a diverse staff. He runs a special orientation with every group of new employees.
And I say, I want to know about you, and I want to know about your experience with race. And sometimes jaws drop. Sometimes people get very uncomfortable. I've had people leave.
So in that way, you're trying to create a culture. But how do you...
How do you
translate that into, okay, you want to make sure, like,
so, program... So then we start talking about how it relates to what we do here. And why is race important when it comes to service and restaurants? And I'll tell them, like, an example. I say, you have a Saturday morning, and you're serving brunch, and it's first thing in the morning, and you just open the door, and you're the host at the front. Doesn't matter if you're black or white, you're the host. A black couple walks in, the entire restaurant is open. You walk the black couple all the way to the back and seat them in that booth over there. The best booth in the house, in my opinion. I said, what is the black couple thinking? Right? You're putting them in the back of the room. Why are you hiding me? They get upset. Now, sometimes people will say, I don't want to sit here, and you'll move them. Sometimes they'll just be upset. And then the waiter, the young, perky white waiter, walks up to them and their black couple, and they're not even looking at them because they're looking at the menu. And they're thinking, what a racist fucking place. And all of a sudden, the white waiter is thinking, angry black people, right? And things start to deteriorate. Now, then we say, let's take a white couple. They walk in through the door, and they're the first customers. And you bring the white couple all the way in that corner. What's the white couple thinking?
All the way to the same table.
Same table. What are they thinking?
Oh, look, we got the best table.
Windows, exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. What a quaint little space. We got the whole place to ourselves. It's even empty. Like, how cute is that? So the idea of I'm blind to race gets you in trouble. I don't want you ever to be blind to race. When you see a table walk in, racialize them immediately and understand how you represent. If you're a white, blonde man and you're waiting on two elderly black women, the experience is going to be very different than if you're a young black man waiting on two elderly black women. And you have to accommodate for that. I'm not saying that you have to give better service or worse service. Just be aware. Be aware of your presence and modulate. Modulate your energy. Modulate your behavior. It's very key, I think, to being able to create a place that is welcoming.
Can a restaurant be for everybody?
I think we can certainly try. I don't think any restaurant can be for everybody. I mean, we have people that can't afford to eat here or drink here. That's not going to be for everybody. But it certainly can be for the majority of people and be representative of the community that it's in.
We asked Andy about some of the criticisms that Busboys receives. The idea that the mural or the whole approach in general are somehow pandering.
I grew up here when Martin Luther King was assassinated. I was alive. I was here and I experienced it. To me, he's my leader as well. He's not a black leader. He's not a different... He's also a leader that I looked up to. So I don't want to say, well, I can't touch him because he's black. That doesn't make sense. I think there's also a difference between exploitation and uplifting of a culture. We don't just put up like pictures of iconic figures on the wall and everything else is like different. We actually integrate what we do into all the things that we do. For a lot of people, I think, who see this as pandering maybe,
there are people of the school that says, you know what, if we keep talking about this stuff, it's going to keep around. It's going to continue to be a problem for us. Maybe if we just move on, that is just not going to happen. That's not how change takes place. I think in order for us to become post-racial, that I think everyone probably would love to see, we have to become more racial. We have to become more, we have to allow people the comfort of their own identity first before they can come out of it. When people aren't comfortable in their own identity, it's very difficult to pull them away from it. What we do here is really allow for everybody's identity to come through, to feel like they see themselves in this space. They see themselves with the people sitting next to them eating. They see themselves in the person that's serving them or the person that's managing the place. So I think that helps people to feel more comfortable in their own skin. And once they do that, they're able to move on.
So that's the first episode of our series, Who Is This Restaurant For? We've got three more coming out this week. Tomorrow, we'll look at one type of restaurant coding in particular. What do the people working at a place look like? And what judgments does that lead us to make about the food?
If you go to an Asian restaurant, the expectation of authenticity is that the servers should be Asian-ish.
I'll talk with a Chinese-American who worked as a sushi chef in a place where just about all the customers assumed he was Japanese.
Like, I was performing my ethnicity to a certain extent. It felt a little bit like having to wear one of those sandwich boards or something. It didn't make me beam with pride.
That's tomorrow, and then later in the week, we'll have my conversation with comedian W. Kamau Bell.
Excuse me, my wife ordered this meal, and she's not really liking it. She got through. Would it be okay? If not, I'm 6'4".
That one will drop Thursday. But right now, it's time for me to say goodbye to my friend and colleague, Kat Chow, who covers race and culture for the NPR blog and podcast Code Switch. Kat, thank you so much.
Thanks, Dan.
Before I let you go, why don't you tell folks a little bit about some of the other shows you guys have been working on recently at the Code Switch podcast?
We did one about a letter that young Asian Americans wrote to their families about why they should care about Black Lives Matter. So kind of looking at these generational differences. And then we also had a more recent one about Tupac, the rapper, and it came out kind of on the 20th anniversary of his death.
It's a great show. It's called Code Switch, the podcast from NPR. Thanks again, Kat.
Thanks, Dan.
Please remember to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get it. That way you'll never miss an episode. Go ahead. You can do it right now while you're listening. Thank you. This show is a production of WNYC Studios and The Sporkful. It's produced by Ann Sani and me. Editing help from Shoshana Gold, Rebecca Carroll, Lee Hill, and Irva Gunja. Music help from Black Label Music. Special thanks to Paula Schumann. And thanks to all our friends at NPR and Code Switch, especially Kat Chow, Gene Demby, Keith Woods, Allison McAdam, Izzy Smith, and Rund Abdel Fattah. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
I'm Shalita from Wallkill, New York, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.